And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth as we confront a great question. The question is, what do you call people who are willing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of a few pennies? What do you call people who are willing to pay with blood, their own blood, for money? Do you call them greedy materialists? Do you call them fanatics? Do you call them madmen? The answer is no, this is America, so we have a special name for people like that. We call them the founding fathers of this republic. Because today, a holiday, on a very special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, we're going to confront questions that many Americans find uncomfortable. Were the founding fathers of this country, Washington and Adams and Jefferson and Franklin and Madison and all the rest, were they really all about money? And if they were, should we feel embarrassed about that? We have a very special program. It's called The Coming of the Revolution, Why They Fought. On the surface of it, the level of sacrifice that the Americans made in their revolutionary struggle makes very little sense. The sacrifice was profound. The best estimates are that over 25,000 young men gave their lives in the struggle for independence. Now, considering the population of the colonies at that time, that would be the equivalent of 2 million deaths today. 2 million in this struggle. The only war in our history that was similarly costly was the war between the states. And meanwhile, why were they fighting? What was the problem? What led them to put their lives on the line? It was not that much money. Everybody knows the old slogan, no taxation without representation. But we were talking about levels of taxation that were vastly less than the kind of levels of taxation we pay today. So what was the fighting about, especially when you consider how prosperous the American colonies were? They were the most prosperous area of the entire world. People back home in England didn't live as well, not even close. As a matter of fact, a gentleman named Richard Oswald testified before Parliament in 1766. And he said to Parliament, no people in the world live more comfortably than the people of America. They are the happiest farmers. The climate is good, and hitherto the taxes have been easy. The provisions, meaning the food, are under half the price of England. People lived extraordinarily well. In fact, his verdict back in 1766 agrees with what more recent historians say. In the 1970s, a historian named Edward J. Perkins analyzed the living standards of people in the American colonies, and he said flat out, quote, the material standard of living enjoyed by the typical white family unit in the 13 mainland English colonies was almost certainly the highest in the world by the 1770s. Usually we associate revolutions with all kinds of hardships, with starvation and oppression and people rotting away in jail and people dying en masse. If you take a look at these 13 colonies strung out along the eastern seaboard, well, they were very favored places. People lived well. And not only that, the country that they were dealing with, the country of England, had just come off the greatest victory in its history. So why would decent people, people who themselves were very successful and very prosperous, risk absolutely everything to create a new nation? To begin to answer that question, you've got to go back to another war. The American Revolution absolutely grew out of an earlier conflict, a huge triumph for England. That was what was known here, on this side of the Atlantic, as the French and Indian War, and was known through the rest of the world as the Seven Years' War. Now, the French and Indian War, make no mistake, it was not about a war between the French and the Indians. It was a war in which the French, who claimed the biggest part of North America, the French claimed everything from Mexico to the North Pole and from the Allegheny Mountains to the Rockies. They claimed all of that for themselves. And they had only 75,000 people living up in what is Quebec today, part of Canada. But they were absolutely determined to keep the English from coming into their territories as frontiersmen, as settlers, as pioneers. And to help prevent that, they mobilized Indian allies. The English had their Indian allies, too, the Iroquois, but basically it became known as the French and Indian War because whenever the colonists and the British troops from back home were fighting, they were fighting both the French and the Indians. And after tremendous struggle and some horrendous battles that included some of the bloodiest days in the history of British arms, the British won a glorious victory, seizing the French capital, the capital of New France, at Quebec, and sweeping, basically, French control out of North America. And this was absolutely hailed as a miraculous victory. It came along with all kinds of other British victories, victories in the West Indies, in the continent of India, in Europe, in the Mediterranean and the Atlantic, naval victories. Everywhere, Britain seemed to win. And no one was happier about that. This sweeping victory, getting rid of the French and their claim to North America, than the American colonists. I mentioned that the French were about 75,000. The American colonists at the end of the French and Indian War were almost 2 million. By the time of the Revolution, they were 2.6 million. So it was a far more developed kind of society. And throughout the American colonies, all the way from Georgia, which was just getting started, all the way up to New Hampshire, there were celebrations. People lit bonfires, bells rang out in churches, people fired off their guns in celebration. Yeah, a lot of people had guns and liked them just fine and fired them off to celebrate. They threw festive banquets, they marched in parades. And one typical sentiment was expressed in a congregation in Brookfield, Massachusetts, by the minister of that congregation, whose name was Eli Forbes, who said, "God has given us to sing this day the downfall of New France, the North American Babylon, New England's rival." He said, "Methinks I see towns enlarged, settlements increased, and this howling wilderness become a fruitful field which the Lord hath blessed. And to complete the scene, I see churches rise and flourish in every Christian grace where has been the seat of Satan and Indian idolatry." Well, you can say he was a little bit on the judgmental side, but you get the idea. Americans welcomed this tremendous liberation of the French influence on the frontier, the French putting their Indian allies up to attacking frontier outposts, the whole threat that you simply weren't secure where you lived, that the future of your colony, of your province, wouldn't be secure. That was all wiped away by this sweeping British victory, amazing victory in the Battle of Quebec, that ended the French and Indian War. But why then did this great victory have in it the seeds of a future conflict? Well, there were a couple of reasons. First of all, from the British side, the British put in a tremendous amount of money and a tremendous amount of men to beat the French in North America. And right after the war, right after the French had surrendered, there were more troubles with other Indian tribes. What happened was there was what was called Pontiac's Conspiracy or Pontiac's Rebellion. There was a chief of the Ottawa tribe known as Pontiac who helped coordinate an uprising all along the frontier. The reason he did that and was able to be successful in getting a lot of his colleagues to join in that coordinated uprising against the British was because the British were so taxed out. They had spent so much money on the war, they wanted to save money. So they stopped the gifts, you can read bribes for that, beads and blankets and guns and other things to their Indian allies, and the Indians didn't like being cut off from gifts. So the result was a disaster on the frontier. Every major fort, except for Fort Pitt, which later became Pittsburgh, and the fort in Detroit, was wiped out. So the British were determined they had to keep 10,000 armed men in North America, British regulars. That was going to cost money. Who was going to pay for that kind of army? Who was going to pay for the £133 million debt that England faced after its victory in the Seven Years' War? Well, it looked like those rich, prosperous, privileged, spoiled, and often arrogant American colonists would be a good source of money. It seemed reasonable, but that determination to milk the colonists for revenue ended up leading directly to independence and revolution. tell you how and why. Coming along. What would lead the colonial patriots to risk everything, to risk their lives, their fortunes, and yes, their sacred honors, for the sake of what seems like, oh, a trivial dispute about taxes? That's what a skeptic might say. To understand what happened, what led to the American Revolution, it's first essential to understand the impact of the French and Indian War. For the British, the French and Indian War was a glorious triumph, but it left the entire nation with this crushing debt. And who better to pay off that debt, at least according to the leaders of Parliament and the leader of King George's ministries, than the American colonists? Why? Because, first of all, they were the most prosperous element of the empire. They were doing phenomenally well. And secondly, they were the ones who benefited most from the war. The French, who had been their threat, their nightmare, their neighbors, they were wiped away, were no longer a threat and no longer in power. So why not force the Americans, if necessary, to coax them, if possible, into paying a fair share of the obligation and the cost of this war? It made a great deal of sense on the surface because, by any measure, Americans, on average, were taxed much more lightly than people back home in England, who, according to most estimates, paid somewhere between 10 and 20 times the percentage of their incomes in taxes. The problem is that that was the way the French and Indian War influenced the English. But as far as the American colonists were concerned, there were different messages from the French and Indian War. Message number one was the French threat was gone. All of a sudden, you don't need the British Navy nearly as much. You don't need to call upon regular troops from the mother country. Point number two is during the years of the struggle, 5 years of intensive struggle in the New World, the American colonists got to see that the British regulars were not invincible. They had a lot of problems with them. A lot of the troops who were supposed to be quartered in colonial homes were lowlives. They were people with bad morals. They were people from the dregs of society, and some of the proper middle class and above American merchants noted that. One of the big differences between British and American enlisted men during the French and Indian War was morality. The American armies, the provincial armies, held two religious services in camp every Sunday. And they banned all bawdy songs, profanity, and card playing all through the week. They drank a lot, but then again, all Englishmen drank a lot at that time. The immorality that American visitors to London often commented about was very obvious in the British military camps. There's one private whose name is Joseph Nichols, who walked through a British camp near Fort Ticonderoga and, quote, observed but little profanity among our provincials, but among the regulars, much profaneness. Colonial newspapers played up all kinds of stories of these British troops, the lobster bellies or lobster backs, the redcoats, stealing, drinking to excess, and even committing murder. Ezra Stiles, who later became president of Yale College, complained that infidelity and gratification of the appetites dominated the British. And he worried that American morals and religion, in quotes, were endangered by contact with the Europeans in the present war. In other words, a lot of Americans assumed we're better than they are. And in some cases, you could say that they certainly were. There was another fact that people drew conclusions about after the French and Indian War, which is that these 13 very disparate colonies, colonies that had differences in religious focus, differences in ethnic focus often, because not everybody was of English ancestry. There were lots of Scots-Irish people, lots of Scottish people, lots of Irish people. 10% of the population in the colonies spoke German as their first language. So there were differences from colony to colony, but the French and Indian War showed those colonists that they could work together. They could come together in time of crisis. So if they could come together in time of crisis and cooperate with the mother country, they could theoretically come together in time of crisis if necessary, to resist and to defy the mother country. It's very important to take note that even before the struggle with the French, there had been a powerful historical development that had emphasized this idea of American unity, which was to make the entire revolution possible. That was the religious movement called the Great Awakening. The Great Awakening is an amazing story all its own. And it's a story that in some ways maybe begins in Northampton, Massachusetts, where all of a sudden in the 1730s, Jonathan Edwards, who was the leading minister in Northampton, says people in his congregation, for no apparent reason, start feeling the Holy Spirit and seeing their lives changed. And there's a new spirit of purification and coming closer to God. That was all given a lot of energy by a number of British preachers who came to the New World and preached with great impact. John Wesley, who's credited as the founder of Methodism, was one of them. But the most famous was a preacher known as the Boy Preacher named George Whitefield, who was an absolutely spellbinding orator who traveled all up and down the North American colonies, speaking to huge crowds. And what Whitefield was able to do was to speak with his resounding voice to as many as 30,000 people in the open air, and to touch all of them. He was the Billy Graham of his era, absolutely tireless, going everywhere. One of the great stories is that he came to Philadelphia. And even though Benjamin Franklin was not a conventionally religious man, he was determined that he wanted to hear George Whitefield. But he promised that he would not give him more than a shilling when he passed the collection plate. But all of a sudden, after he heard Whitefield preach, he gave 4 gold sovereigns, all the money he had on him, and put it in a collection plate, and people sort of laughed at him. Franklin said he wanted to go back the next night, but this time he would not take his purse because he didn't want to part with any more money. Remember, Ben Franklin was a guy who said a penny saved is a penny earned. And so the story is recorded that after Whitefield spoke, people saw Benjamin Franklin weeping and taking out his gold watch and putting that in the collection plate. Benjamin Franklin said, "It was wonderful to see the change soon made in the manners of our inhabitants. From being thoughtless or indifferent about religion, it seemed as if all the world were growing religious, so that one could not walk through the town in an evening without hearing psalms sung in different families of every street." Now, this was his response to this 25-year-old preacher. But one of the things that Whitefield accomplished before his death in 1770 was to overcome a lot of the religious differences in the colonies. His revivals drew on Quakers, drew on Presbyterians, drew on Lutherans, drew on every sort of Christians, Anglicans and Congregationalists, and all of a sudden allowed people to see that they were one nation with a common, perhaps even godly, mission. It was a tremendously important welding process that helped the colonies weather the tremendous challenges of the French and Indian War and have an even greater feeling of unity as they faced the challenges to come, with the British Crown and Parliament determined to get some money back for their investment in that French and Indian War. All of a sudden, with unity, people felt they had the spirit and the ability to resist.
You're listening to a special history broadcast of The Michael Medved Show. For more history programs, go to medvedhistorystore.com or become a Medhead at michaelmedved.com and check out our new history podcast for premium members called In Light of History.
The coming of the revolution, why they fought. You can't understand why they fought and why they so willingly risked their lives unless you understand one of the crucial mistakes that King George and his ministers made in London right after the French and Indian War, right after Pontiac's Rebellion, right after they determined that they needed to get the Americans to pay their fair share of keeping 10,000 royal troops on North American soil. Part of the mistake that they made was they touched an area of American life that was absolutely sacred and should have been deemed untouchable. I'm not now talking about the church, though that was sacred too. I'm talking about rum. I mean, rum was very, very serious business for the American colonists. So much so that people who have studied the records of consumption at that time have come away scratching their heads in amazement that everybody in North America didn't just end up drinking themselves to death. According to one historian who's analyzed these figures, while precise consumption figures are lacking, informed estimates suggest that by the 1790s, an average American over 15 years old drank just under 6 gallons of absolute alcohol every year. The comparable modern average is less than 2.9 gallons per capita. There was an amazing consumption of booze. And part of that was based on the American idea that it was necessary to drink for your health. Very often, every morning would begin with a stiff drink. What did they drink? They liked to drink hard cider. That was the most popular drink throughout the colonies because people grew apples almost everywhere, and you could make hard cider out of that. Rum was a close second. Now, rum was used to celebrate almost every special occasion. Rum or cider. In 1767, in Middlesex County, Massachusetts alone, 33,436 barrels of cider were produced. That's 7 barrels per family. One writer has remarked that colonial Americans drank enough hard cider in a single day to make modern Americans woozy for a week. They also liked all kinds of elaborate drinks. One of the ones that I was interested in is in Philadelphia, they drank something called a creaming flip, which was roast pumpkin mixed together with strong beer and rum, mixed all together with a roast pumpkin, and then they would put in a hot iron that would fizz in the drink and sort of give it a burnt, crispy taste that connoisseurs just loved. In any event, all of this booze was made possible because of a big trade in rum, particularly in New England. They would get sugar and molasses from the West Indies and bring it up to New England and then refine it into rum. And the rum was then sent all around the world. It was sent to some extent to Africa to buy slaves, who would then be sent to the West Indies, and the West Indies would send more sugar and molasses to make more rum. It was all a very profitable business. There was only one problem. A lot of it was smuggled. They were supposed to be paying 6 cents, 6 pence, for every gallon of sugar or molasses that they were getting to be made into rum. But no one was paying it. George Grenville, who took over as Chancellor of the Exchequer and had a head for numbers, he was really a big clerk in power, all of a sudden noticed something. He noticed that when it came to enforcing the sugar tax, the molasses tax, which had everything to do with rum, it was costing the king more than it was bringing in. So he had a great idea. His idea was this. They would cut the rum tax. That should make the Americans happy. The molasses tax, the sugar tax. He'd cut it from 6 cents per gallon down to 3 cents a gallon, and everybody should be happy. The only problem is he planned absolutely to enforce it. And this was not popular because all of a sudden there were a number of bureaucrats sent to the New World, sent to the colonies, who were determined to catch smugglers. And part of what was happening here was they were given a financial incentive to do so. Because the more smugglers you caught, the more people that you dragged back to England or tried in special admiralty courts, no trial by juries here, the more money you could make as a customs agent, as a customs inspector. The Americans howled. But the sugar tax, as bad as it was, as unpopular as it was nothing as compared with the Stamp Act, the stamp tax, another attempt to try desperately to get some money out of these very prosperous American economies. And the Stamp Act produced what nearly was a revolution 11 years before those fateful days of 1776. I'll explain to you why, coming right back.
This
This is Michael Medved at michaelmedved.com for Town Hall. Yes, America is dealing with a toxic legacy of racism, but it's destructive to frame all problems in racial terms. For instance, a panelist for Project Homeless of the Seattle Times boldly declared, "To be blunt, there is no homelessness in America without racism. It simply wouldn't exist." Now, this is frankly insane. All studies of homelessness show more white people living on the streets than blacks or Hispanics. Statistics prove African Americans are 72 times more likely to own their own homes than to count as homeless. Moreover, is racism the sole cause for mental illness and substance abuse, which are the chief drivers of the homeless explosion, especially for the white plurality among the homeless? The idea that the thousands of street people who challenge health and safety in every big city would magically find homes if it weren't for racism is so illogical it detracts from any serious efforts to cope with the problem. I'm Michael Medved.
You're listening to a special history broadcast of The Michael Medved Show. For more history programs, go to MedvedHistoryStore.com or become a Medhead at MichaelMedved.com.
What upset the American colonists so much about the Sugar Act? The Sugar Act involved cutting the amount of taxes that people had to pay on importing sugar or molasses. What upset them was the fact that England suddenly got serious about enforcing this tax. And that the American assemblies in each one of the colonies had absolutely nothing to say on the issue. This was the heart of the problem, is that with this huge ocean in between London and the New World, there had grown up in every one of the colonies, in Massachusetts and in Virginia and in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania and in South Carolina, North Carolina, all of them, independent legislatures, local assemblies that had been used to making decisions. Decisions like what way we are going to tax the people. And all of a sudden, when Parliament started making a decision about raising or lowering or enforcing a sugar tax, which impacted Americans greatly because of the importance of the whole rum industry to the colonies, this seemed to be grabbing authority away from these local assemblies. That was bad enough, and it led to protests, particularly in the New England colonies. But even worse was the follow-up to the Sugar Act, which was the Stamp Act. According to the duties of the Sugar Act, even if they were able to enforce it entirely with these new customs commissioners, it would bring in only £45,000 a year. That was a long way from paying the £325,000 it would take to support the Royal Army in America, let alone to begin paying off some of the national debt that England was struggling with. So the Prime Minister, Grenville, had another idea. It was an idea to force the Americans to pay the same kind of tax on paper goods that absolutely everyone, nearly everyone in England paid, a stamp tax. What that meant was that if you wanted to file a will, if you wanted to get a mortgage, if you wanted to get a license, if you wanted to get playing cards or stationery or college diplomas or anything involving paper, you had to get it from a stamp commissioner who would stamp the paper as official and charge you a little bit extra for it. Yes, it was obnoxious, but it seemed to work okay in England. And I don't think anyone expected the level of protest that occurred immediately in America. The protest was so ferocious, so fierce, that in Parliament, there were friends in America, like the parliamentary hero of the French and Indian War, William Pitt, who stood up and said that the colonists should be allowed to tax themselves, that this was a misguided policy to try to burden the colonies with this sort of tax.
You're listening to a special history broadcast of The Michael Medved Show. For a complete list of history shows, visit MedvedHistoryStore.com.
At this point, a playboy in Parliament named Charles Townsend stood up, and this is one of the more memorable parliamentary debates of the period. Charles Townsend was known as Champagne Charlie because he liked to spend most of his time partying. He gave nearly all of his parliamentary speeches stone drunk. Apparently, he was much better when he was drunk. And Champagne Charlie, who was to go on to play a very important role in bringing on the American Revolution, leaped to his feet, and he made a condescending attack on the colonists. What he said regarding this idea that the tax would be a burden on the colonies, what he said was, "And now, will these Americans, children planted by our care, nourished up by our indulgence until they are grown to a degree of strength and opulence and protected by our arms, will they grudge to contribute their might to relieve us from the heavy burden which we lie under?" To respond to Champagne Charlie, a tough-spoken veteran of the French and Indian struggle stood up. His name was Colonel Isaac Barré. He was French-Irish. He had fought with the British at the climactic Battle of Quebec, actually lost an eye in that battle, and he answered Townsend in words that became famous throughout the American colonies. What Colonel Barré said was, "They planted by your care? No, your oppressions planted them in America. They fled your tyranny to a then uncultivated and inhospitable country. They nourished by your indulgence. They grew by your neglect of them. As soon as you began to care about them, that care was exercised by sending persons to rule over them in one department or another, who were sent to spy out their liberty, men whose behavior on many occasions has caused the blood of these sons of liberty to recoil within them. They, protected by your arms, they have nobly taken up arms in your defense, have exerted a valor amidst their constant and laborious industry for the defense of their country. Remember, I this day told you so, that same spirit of freedom which actuated these people at first will accompany them still." Well, his words were celebrated. It made him a hero throughout the colonies. And one phrase that he used, he said, "these sons of liberty," that phrase was soon adopted by a number of clubs that had sprung up specifically to resist taxation and the Stamp Act and what was seen as tyranny by the British. One of the things that was so obnoxious about the Stamp Act and the stamp tax was that payment had to be in hard money, which almost doubled its cost in most colonies. Paper money that had been issued by those colonies was no longer acceptable. It felt like the English were determined to take control away from the colonial assemblies. And worst of all, anybody who was found violating any aspect of the stamp tax would be tried not by a jury of his or her peers, but would be tried by admiralty courts. Well, what happened was that all of a sudden, people who were sent out by the British with, just shiploads full of stamped paper and were sent to be stamp collectors here in the New World to try to make some money out of this thing, were basically treated very, very rudely. They were hung in effigy. On August 26th, 1765, a mob stormed the home of one of the officials of Massachusetts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson, who had had his own two sons, were supposed to be stamp collectors. They tore the wainscoting off the wall, smashed his doors, chopped down the fruit trees in the garden, flung into the street a manuscript of a history of the Massachusetts colony, and generally terrorized him. There were no police officers available, regular police officers in cities. The army wasn't there to take care of him. And basically, no one was willing to actually collect this stamp tax. So what were the British to do? Were we going to come to blows over this issue? We'll explain, coming right back. This is Michael Medved at michaelmedved.com for Town Hall. To mainstream media, the designation black conservative represents a contradiction in terms. Conventional wisdom insists African Americans must automatically identify as progressive or even radical to be true to their racial identity. But a bold new film explodes that patronizing assumption with passion, wit, and a series of admirable examples. Uncle Tom features black leaders like Alan West, Herman Cain, Robert Woodson, Candace Owens, and my talk radio colleague Larry Elder, who's also one of the film's producers.
Without narration or an overarching storyline, the film provides insightful, sometimes intimate observations in vivid black and white, so the contemporary comments blend seamlessly with stunning historical footage. Along with eloquent vintage photographs, these clips bring to life great figures, from Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington to Dr. King himself. Uncle Tom is perfectly timed, making a much-needed contribution to the quest for justice and understanding at a moment of accusatory hysteria and race relations. I'm Michael Medved.
Ten years before the fighting at Lexington and Concord began the American Revolution, the Stamp Act crisis gave a sneak preview to anybody who would be paying attention about the inevitable nature of this conflict. The Parliament had decided we are going to tax these colonies, just like we tax people at home in England. We're going to tax them with stamps. The colonists resisted. They resisted so ferociously, with so much mob violence, with such unanimity of opinion, that on November 1st, 1765, the day the Stamp Act was supposed to go into effect, there wasn't a single stamp commissioner who had been able to set himself up in business anywhere in America. More than that, the Sons of Liberty and the other colonists had been able to intimidate people to such an extent that there wasn't a single ship that would be allowed to sail to England from their ports. They basically had instituted a very effective boycott, saying, okay, we're not trading with the mother country, even though we are going to be giving up a lot of money and a lot of comfort until they drop this tax. What was so obnoxious about the tax? It was clearly a revenue tax. When Benjamin Franklin was asked to testify before Parliament, he was in London representing his own home colony of Pennsylvania. He later eventually came to represent the colony of Massachusetts as well, and basically the colonies in general. When Franklin was questioned before Parliament, he did it brilliantly, of course. He did everything brilliantly. But one of the things he allowed the English to believe was that what Americans objected to was an internal tax, the idea of a stamp tax. That should be the business of the colonial assemblies. And he kept emphasizing that, no, we are still your children. You are the mother country. England has the right to regulate trade. So basically, after months, after a whole Stamp Act Congress was called, where nine different colonies were represented, the closest thing that they had come to any kind of unification since the middle of the French and Indian War, in response to all of that and this determined opposition, Parliament and the King and his ministers decided to retreat. A new prime minister came in, the Marquess of Rockingham. He said, what is this? It is not worth it. There are not enough British soldiers available to enforce the Stamp Act. Let's drop it. And they got Parliament to do that, but only along with the issuance of what was called the Declaratory Act, an act that declared that, all right, we're going to pull back on the Stamp Act. No more tax on stamps, but we have the right to tax these colonies anytime and any way that we want. In the midst of the celebration throughout America, throughout the American colonies, people didn't pay much attention to that Declaratory Act. But as events developed, it became clear that they should have. We'll continue the story of the coming of the revolution, why they fought.
To purchase this show, go to MedvedStore.com or call 855-880-7206. That's 855-880-7206.
Whatever the controversies, whatever the surprises in the world around us at the moment, it's important to get some perspective, and no better source of perspective than the history of this great country. At MedvedHistoryStore.com, check out some of the titles we have on offer about the Constitution, about the origins of our tax system, about the history of third parties, about the question of whether America really is a Christian or is it a secular nation. There's a trick answer to that trick question. Enrich your understanding and appreciation with CDs and MP3 downloads at MedvedHistoryStore.com.
Not just the Amen chorus. It's your daily dose of debate.
Amen. I listen to you a lot, and I don't agree with anything you say.
The Michael Medved Show.
You should be taken off the air.